You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm joined today with my guest, Marion Mester, keynote speaker, and just all-around fantastic individual. How are you doing today, Mary?
I'm good. Sam, how are you?
I'm doing great, doing great. So you and I met at Kansas City B2B. You were doing a keynote, and it was a fantastic keynote, by the way, in that I really enjoyed you really kind of put on a show. You were regularly kind of changing things up. It was easy to keep focus. And then what I personally enjoyed was, at least for me, you did a pretty good job of reconnecting me emotionally to the dream. And I was actually just telling somebody the other day, because I was in a podcast thing, and I was saying, you know, your mission has to supersede basically all, because you'll do things in moments that are a bit uncomfortable to your personality. Like maybe you're an introvert, you're having to meet somebody new and that conversation. And if your mission isn't of the utmost, you won't do that. It'll be difficult to do that. You won't do that. And you'll burn out faster because of these more things that you're having to do. And so anyway, all that to say, it's really valuable for us to regularly emotionally reconnect with the mission, because that's what keeps us going. And I felt like you helped do that. So just wanted to give you that compliment, if you will.
I appreciate that. I fully agree, you know, obviously, because you're in the audience, but I fully agree with everything that you said, and whether it's called a mission or it's a dream or just some big, bold thing that you're working towards. If you do not have, and it's probably not an emotional connection throughout the entire process, but an emotional connection to why you're reaching for that thing that you're reaching for, the process is going to be draining, or you're going to get burnt out, or you're going to be reaching for something that if you achieve it and it creates an undesired emotion in you, then, you know, that's a whole other, I guess, spin out that could happen in response. So the emotional process of getting there is important, but I think connecting to the emotions of what that end state looks like or feels like for you or for other people, that's kind of the North Star.
Yeah, I like that you called it a North Star. So let's kind of start with where you're at now, so people can kind of come to understand you a little bit more, and then we'll do the kind of traditional rewind the clock, so to speak.
Okay. Well, this is what you and I discussed earlier of, is it part of the introduction or is it not? So I'll tee it up and then maybe we can dissect that a little bit.
Yeah.
So yes, I am a keynote speaker and I speak about creativity in the workplace. And when I say that, I actually mean a couple things. The first one is permission to allow ourselves and others simply to think about things a little bit differently. That in and of itself is a creative process, and allowing that process to take place is what truly drives innovation and advancement inside companies and also inside ourselves. I have a workflow or a framework that I follow that I guide on the audiences through, but that's what I'm up to these days is speaking with audiences on that very topic.
That's good. Okay. All right. So thank you for teeing it up. So now to that end, let's kind of rewind the clock a little bit. And I like to set the stage for high school, the high school period. And the reason I set the stage there, and sometimes we end up rewinding it a little bit further, but the reason I like to set the stage there is because I feel like that is when exterior influences tend to be kind of at their maximum on what are you going to do. You know, I'm reading a book now where his entire life's career choice essentially hinged on a buddy right around high school saying we should do this, right? And so I'm kind of curious about what was your first real dream that you inherited or were given or took on the mantle of?
Okay, I love this. I haven't thought about this high school thing in a really long time, so I'm glad that you started here. When I was in high school, I was going to be, if you'd asked me, 16-year-old Mary, I would have said, I want to be a nurse. And that was my dream, was to go to nursing school to become a nurse. I wanted specifically to work in the NICU. A large number of people in my family are in the healthcare profession. So it is something that I had grown up around. And when I was in high school, I would spend sometimes spring breaks or weeks in the summer out in California with my aunt and her daughter, who were both neonatal intensive care unit nurses. And this was like back before HIPAA, when there weren't quite as many restrictions on what you could and couldn't do. And I would go shadow them and I'd see the babies and I would attend deliveries, these high risk deliveries of babies being born. It was the coolest experience. So that was the high school dream, was to be a NICU nurse. And I'm not doing that today.
That right. And I want to keep going and make it more about you, but you said the days before HIPAA, and this is just fun side tangent that doesn't mean anything, but I want to get it stuck in your head because it's stuck in mine forevermore, especially when people say stuff like that. I went to the Renaissance Festival but once, and one of the things that I absolutely enjoyed the most was this side booth. It was these two women, probably nurses in their day job, but I'm just assuming, they were singing, "We're living in the days before HIPAA. So many secrets that we love. Hip, hip away, we can give them all the way because we don't have any indiscretion." And they just, and then they'd point out people in the crowd and they'd say, "Oh, looks like he has." And then they just sing their thing again and they keep going. It was so much fun.
Okay, how long ago was this and how did you happen to remember that entire thing?
Oh my goodness, it had to have been at least. How long ago was that? Oh my goodness. Probably in excess of 5 years. Ooh, maybe even longer than that. And it made a very real impression, especially because I was doing IT in healthcare at the time. Huh? And that HIPAA stuff, it's pretty serious. But it was funny to think about because it was a joke on all fronts, right? I mean, they were just that stuff. But then on the same token, how many people, you'd hope original healthcare professionals weren't just blabbing about other people's problems.
Uh-huh. Yes, you would hope. That is true.
All right, sorry. Now that that's stuck in your head.
Yeah, thank you.
So that's not what you're doing today. So help me out with that. So you're going to go to nursing school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you go to nursing school? Did you get that far?
I did not. So I went to KU, University of Kansas, and I went there because of the nursing program that was down at KU Medical Center. And I spent my first couple years doing all of kind of the undergraduate courses. And I applied to nursing school and I didn't get in to nursing school. And there was a time when I would not tell people that whole story. I'm well past that now because I think that's an important part of it. But I enjoyed the social aspects of college quite a bit. And my B average that felt good enough, it wasn't good enough. And so I applied to college or I applied to nursing school and I didn't get into nursing school. And that was a moment, a little bit of panic. Obviously, when that whole dream changes and, there's the opportunity to say, yeah, we'll try again next year. But it did force a bit of a reflection to say kind of what we talked about earlier, that emotional piece. So if the reason I'm going to be a nurse is because I really do have this deep desire to connect with people, to make a difference for individuals, to change someone's life, hopefully for the better. If that's the emotional purpose for me doing this, what other ways could I still tap into that? Because healthcare for me was such a beautiful way to make all of that happen. So what else could I do to still reach that end emotional state? And the fascinating part about this was that all roads lead to my grandmother. So my grandmother had both my grandmothers had college degrees, but the one I'm specifically thinking of, her degree was as a medical records librarian. And that sounded very unexciting to me, but it was a little bit of a moment to say, maybe there's something else here in healthcare that I could start playing with. Medical records librarian today, the degree is called health information management, which you might have overlapped with, and because there are sometimes some connections between. Is this new?
Maybe. Okay. I have zero clue what this is. I'm sitting here like, what is a medical records librarian or
Okay, so medical records librarian, like in the olden days, which if I think about my grandmother's days, but there was so much of this that was still true, you know, 20 years ago when I was getting out of college. It is the space where the physical paper medical records lived. And so that's, you kept them and you saved them and you pulled them for people to read and all of that. So like the basics of what pre-technology healthcare space kind of looked like. When I started researching this, I realized that now it is no longer a solo degree in and of itself to say medical records librarian. It falls under the umbrella of this health information management degree, which is a huge degree for, yes, medical records management, but also healthcare IT, which is obviously IT and medical records now go hand in hand. Billing lived in that space. Insurance kind of lived in that space. It was this entire inner workings of all of the business aspects that supported the healthcare space. And I got kind of fascinated by it because the other thing that I really, from an emotional standpoint, wanted to connect into was this opportunity to always challenge myself and to grow professionally and take on new roles. And so I always knew even when I was going to be a nurse, I wanted to go on to be a nurse practitioner and then, you know, continue my education and see what else was there. Well, the business landscape offered a lot of opportunities to do that. So I spent a semester at Johnson County Community College, and I took a whole bunch of business courses to try and round out that area of my prerequisites. And then I started still at the University of Kansas Medical Center, but now instead of being a nursing student, I was a health information management student.
Yeah. And that, I mean, you're right. There's enough overlap to where it's absolutely fascinating to me, just the degree of interplay there. So the best thing for me about IT, especially if you're kind of like in a smaller infrastructure or like health clinic, you get to go between all the departments, right? So you get to see CPT code billing. And for somebody like me who really doesn't mind asking what some might call stupid questions, I don't know, I get to be like, what the heck is CPT code billing? And it's like, well, we have to codify the patient's chief complaint in such a way that insurance takes it and pays out. And which, you're right, jumps into the insurance bit. And then all of that is information from point A to point B. And then the insurance element of it is fascinating too, because insurance, specifically in tech, are actually driving more change from a cybersecurity perspective, I would say right now, than HIPAA or other compliance vehicles, because those compliance vehicles may or may not have an active auditor, but insurance wants to make sure that they're paying out as little as possible, really, without saying it any different way. And so they're making sure that you're checking all the P's and Q's. And so then they're showing up and making sure that the information is kept correctly, stored correctly, transformed correctly, moved correctly. And so you're right. It does all fall under this super fascinating. It's like it's all its own independent thing, but it can't all be its own independent thing either.
Yes. And I think getting the exposure to that, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about. So the first job that I ended up getting out of college, I was the health information management director at Research Medical Center. And so my department did the CPT codes, and it was ICD-9 at the time, which is now ICD-10. We implemented electronic signature in, I think, my second year there, which now, I say that to people, and in some ways it makes me feel really old to say, yeah, when I first started working in healthcare, everyone was signing with a pen. And no, nobody uses pens anymore. You know, they're signing electronically. Everything's in a computer. And that experience of just the inner workings of how it all played together, it was absolutely fascinating. And then to your point, if I wanted to go hang out in the ER and shadow down there for a little bit, I still could because I was working inside of a hospital. So I felt so connected to the healthcare space. And I still felt like I was adding a lot of value both for me and for people that I interacted with, but in a really different way. So dream started in being a nurse. Now the dream has shifted into nursing adjacent, and you're starting to see, okay, now I got the business side that's coming into play and managing this entire department and the inner workings. And so we're getting closer to what I'm doing today, but you're getting to witness kind of how it all came together.
So let's rewind just a little bit too, slightly. Uh-huh. I didn't realize you had to maintain such a strict grade. I mean, I say strict. I don't know. I'm sure there's probably some, but all right, I'll say it. I was a C kid. A C kid. And it was because, frankly, so I'll give you the perfect example of why me and school were not the greatest mix. I aced labs in comp science 101, and I bombed the exam, and it was the perfect world of 50-50. You know, 50% of your grade was the labs, and 50% of your grade was the exam. And so I made just enough of the exam to get a C, and it was because I could build the infrastructure. But if you asked me what each acronym stood for, which is what the exam largely comprised of, like what does this acronym stand for and what does this acronym stand for and what does this acronym stand for? If you didn't memorize those in the books, I could tell you what they did. I could tell you how to set them up. I could tell you how they interacted with each other. But the moment you were like, what's the acronym stand for? I bombed the exam. And so it's fascinating to me to think, so you had to maintain an A average, uh-huh. I'm guessing, or B plus to get into nursing school. And I have gone my life thus far without any knowledge of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know what it looks like today. So I graduated college in 2004, so should have been 2003. But because of this little hiccup, I ended up on the 5-year plan. So in 2003, which 2002 would have been when I was applying for nursing school, it was very competitive at the time. There were quite a few, and this was true for, I applied to KU's nursing program, and then I did apply also. St. Luke's has a nursing program here in Kansas City too. And I was waitlisted on the St. Luke's one, and then just said, this is not your year for the KU one. And it was highly, highly competitive. I do think that nursing career, and I'm sure COVID especially, has completely changed that landscape on how desirable of a field it is or is not. And truthfully, I don't know what that looks like today. But when I was applying, yes, it you needed to be an A kid. And it's funny that you talk about test taking, and because I think that's the way that we learn and apply ourselves, it's such a unique experience. And it's one that as like a 19-year-old kid, you're still figuring out. And so then you've got these things that rely on your ability to figure that out perfectly when you really are still too young to fully understand it. So my thing was, I knew I could show up to a test and most likely get a B. I was a smart kid, smart enough to get a B with very little effort. And to your point, I could participate in class and I enjoyed the experience and I really did like to learn. And I didn't feel it was necessary to put this whole other level of pressure on myself to get the A when I was quite content with a B. And that's what always drove my mom crazy in high school and college was like, if you would apply yourself, you would be the straight A kid. And I think, and I know that about myself now. So now as an adult.
And to your point, looking back.
Yeah.
I would have probably done it way differently because why not? What else was I doing, right? Playing video games and
hitting the
watching
snooze
movies
button
and shows. Yeah, exactly.
And that's, I think what's interesting now, as an adult, I now know I enjoy being a part of the process. I don't always love the grunt work to get there, but I know that about myself. And so the way that I operate now is I set certain time aside to make sure that I do the preparation and I do the homework and I prepare for the keynote or the exam, if I compare that back 20 years ago, because I know that about myself. And now I know how to make it all work. But man, when you're a kid and you're trying to do a thing that can impact the school that you get into, the profession that you're going after, it's a lot of weight that I guess you maybe don't understand how much weight that is at the time to know to approach it in a different way. I hope that's making sense, but
It's interesting. It's also encouraging, at least for me personally, because I've been taking a lot more personality tests lately, and the more I take, the more I'm just kind of like absolutely intrigued. Because, if nothing else, maybe they're like confirmation. But then also sometimes you're sitting across from a professional, maybe like you even, where it's like when they read that personality test to you and then they tell you in depth what that means. So, for example, you know, I've had somebody tell me, okay, so Sam, you know, you're in a sales role, right? You have this on the disc. I'm a high I. Well, what does that mean? It means you don't like PowerPoint and you don't like presentations. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. So what would probably do best for you is to put more effort into PowerPoint and to presentations. And it's like, oh, okay, wow. And you're right. Like, once you know that about yourself and you're really like thinking through it, it's like, okay, you know, make a point, no matter how difficult it is, to set aside that time to add that little bit of structure to make the presentation that much more of a wow factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's, so you mentioned DISC, and I'm also I style and D style, and I am like as far into the I and D style as you can go. And I hover back and forth between that median between those two.
Really? They're neck and neck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is. And I've taken it several times. And sometimes I'm a little more towards the D style, sometimes a little more towards the I style. But I am as far on the outside of the circle as you can get, which would mean that the S and C style is an area where I don't necessarily thrive. But what I've found is by, let's say, digging into, you know, as a business owner, digging into my spreadsheet and studying my accounts receivable and where money is coming in and going out and studying all of that allows me and my D style to make better decisions and faster decisions and move on to the next thing quickly because I've created a little bit of rigor for myself in the spaces that maybe I don't always choose to play. And so the complementary nature of all of this, I think is really interesting. But it's also something that I really only probably appreciate as an adult, and I can reflect. Probably not something that I appreciated. I mean, I know it's not something I appreciated or fully understood as a kid.
Right. No, I agree. Sometimes I think it's a little bit cruel. Right? Life almost seems to happen in reverse what it should be.
It does.
I would love to go back to school. It would be a much different experience because it'd be like, yeah. We have this period in our life where literally we're allowed to dedicate to learning things. And I love learning things now. But and it's also, to be fair, though, it's also because it's self-directed at my own pace. So maybe if you were to put me back in that setting where it's like, okay, Sam, you have to learn math. Oh, man, I'd probably hate it again. Fair enough. Sorry, I'm making up things that aren't real. I was not a math person either.
And so, now I'm having to learn it. My 10-year-old now, I'm having to text my 10-year-old's teacher to say, will you teach? She's asking for help on this math problem. Teach me what I'm supposed to do. And she's texting me screenshots of the napkin math. So yeah, so now here I am now having to learn it all. And it actually isn't. It's no more fun than it was back then.
Okay, good. All right. That's fast and helpful. All right. So you've got, so going into the administration side, once you discovered that, did you feel like you were surrendering, or was it like, was it legitimately like the more I researched, the more I just absolutely loved that entire notion?
The latter.
Which plays into the D probably, I'm guessing, a lot more on that disc. Okay.
Yeah, I think it does. The nursing side probably plays more into the I style. This more kind of business side probably plays more into some of the D style.
Right. So what was your first career then out of, because you're going to school for it. I don't know if we talked about that first real role. What is that role look like? And was it in what you were going for?
Yeah. So the first job was, my title was Assistant Director of Health Information Management, and that was at Research Medical Center, which is an HCA hospital, so massive healthcare chain. Then Research is one of their largest hospitals in Kansas City. And
that sounds like a cool title.
It was fantastic.
Were you stoked about that title? Because I just hear that title, and I'm like, if that's my first role out of college, I'm stoked.
Yeah. Well, and it's really interesting because I jokingly, but I think this is informed a lot of what I'm doing today, I have never gotten a job that I was qualified for. And I know for a lot of people, that is scary to apply for a job that you meet. I think the only thing was I had a degree, but I had no experience. I had done an internship in college for 1 month. And I went ahead and applied. I think the lucky part of it was this has been a job that was open for a long time and they were having a hard time getting applicants. So I applied. And when I went in for my interview, I said, I mean, I'm 23. I've never done a job like this before, but I had an internship for 30 days at a health information management department in Chicago. I was at Rush University Medical Center. And look at what I did. And I brought this binder that was full of all the notes that I'd taken and some org charts I'd put together. I mean, I just stuffed this thing full to at least say, maybe I don't have the experience, but look, I can do a thing for you. And it looks like this 3-ring binder. And so they said, okay. And they hired me. And, you know, it was an 80-person department and I was the second in command. And a month after they hired me, they had massive layoffs and I had to assist in laying off about half of this team. And it was, it was horrible. It was not just the experience of laying people off. I don't like how I handled it. The director and I
mean, you're 23 and you're, you had little grace here, but I also respect keep going.
I think. You know, I think anytime something like that happens, one, the first time you lay somebody off it's a horrific experience across the board. It's a necessary part of business, sadly to say. And yet I don't think it ever actually gets easier. But I remember being in this role of being young and having to do this alongside. So my boss was the director and she and I sat on one side of the table. And it was one of those scenes where the employee comes in. And then you go in and get the next employee and then you tell them the news. And then, and I mean, it was like for hours, it was about 40 people. And I cried through the whole thing.
The Bobs. I'm thinking of the Bobs, the office. You've seen the office?
It was. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what it was. And I allowed my emotional state with all of this to, I would say, get too much attention. It was not about me. It should have been about the person on the other side of the table who was having so much of their world changed. But because I'd never navigated this before, and I don't think, I mean, I'm still 23. I was still a kid in so many ways. I think, and I've had to do obviously
layoffs
since then.
That's better than, so to make you feel a little bit better, that's better than me at 23. Transparently, I might have been the polar opposite.
Sure.
Like just, I'm just, you know, I might, when you said I struggled to handle it, my mind actually went to the polar opposite of like, oh no, was she really cold? And as a result, cruel? Like, hey, you're fired. On to the next one. Like, see, come on, we got to get through so many today. Because I was a little bit more full of myself then, where it's like, I got an 8-hour day ahead of me or whatever. How quickly can I get through this?
Yeah.
And that's just, you don't want that either. I don't want that person firing me. That's a mean individual.
Well, what I will say, when I've had to do things, you know, as my career continued to evolve and I had different leadership positions that required me to do a layoff like that again, the thing that I took from that was going forward is that it is an emotional experience, but the most important thing is to allow the space for the other person's emotions, because they're the ones whose world just changed. Yes, it's hard to deliver the message, and yes, it's emotional to deliver the message, but for the person that's receiving it, they're the ones that need the space to allow their emotions to fill up the room, to take center stage. And so you know, that's what I learned from that was making sure that I protected that space for the other person.
So what was it like going home after something like that?
Gosh, I haven't thought about a question like that. I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I think it, in retrospect, it probably taught me what I just shared. But I think that, you know, you walk away from any of those moments probably with a hope that it opens up another door for someone else that they don't see right now. And that's potentially a Pollyanna kind of a way to look at it. But I think there's some truth in that just because this position ended, maybe there's something better that's on the horizon.
What's Pollyanna?
I don't know if I was thinking that then. Oh, like everything's always coming up roses and happy-go-lucky skipping through the park type of a thing.
The eternal optimist.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I have the same thing. Actually, it's been fun. The more valleys and difficulties you go through, the more, for me, I've had to almost kind of keep the optimism in check, because there is a point where it's like, okay, I need to take 5 minutes here to be like, and that's kind of how I viewed it. This is what I've told other people, because this has really helped me. I need to take 5 minutes to recognize that life has handed me a big steaming pile of crap. And then I can go back to being optimistic. And I should. But if you don't take that 5 minutes to be like, this is a steaming pile of crap, thanks, then you haven't processed that. You're just going to keep getting it and getting it. You're repressing it.
Yeah.
Almost, even, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's something you can learn from every one of those things. Even if you don't figure out the lesson in the moment, giving yourself space to sit in it, it makes it easier to find it in the future.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. And then, yes, it gives you the ability to recognize it easier in the future. Yes, I think it also allows the space to have processed it emotionally, such that it's not, you're not going to end up with 20 of those in 1 week and then go home and just like,
right.
What? Okay, so this is interesting. So you get that position, over 80 people, have to offboard 40, second in command. So you're managing, help me out here. That's, even at 40 people, you're helping to manage 40 people. That's a lot of people.
It was a lot for a first career out of college. Yes, for sure. Especially at first
what
career.
What was managing? So what was the day-to-day function of that department, I guess? And what was managing 40? What was managing that quantity of people like in general?
Well, so it's back to that idea when we talked about health information management. So the billing, the coding, the management of the medical records, the transcription process, getting records up onto the floor when a patient came in, that was kind of the day-to-day aspect of it. The managerial side was really interesting because most of these individuals that worked there, was a lot of women. There was one man in the department. Interesting story about the one man in the department. My grandmother, who I said had had that medical records librarian degree, she was his boss 30, 40, 50 years earlier, probably 30 years earlier, at another hospital in Kansas City. So I told this story about, oh, yeah, Mary Jane Wiersch. And he said, Mary Jane Wiersch, she was my first boss out of college. And I went, that was my grandmother. So total wild story. And he and I still kept in touch. And so that's fascinating about this full circle thing. But
that's wild.
So, you know, isn't that? It's still kind of is a pinch me moment. Like, this was really what was supposed to happen. And my grandmother's hand was clearly in it, connecting all of these pieces in a way that we didn't even realize. But the from a work standpoint, a lot of it was oversight of the work that these individuals were doing, most of which I mentioned it was a lot of women. It was a lot of people who had been in this job for 20 to 30 years. They knew exactly what they needed to do. But part of this transition and why the layoffs had occurred is the hospital had been bought. It went from a not-for-profit healthcare system, and it had been purchased as a for-profit healthcare system. So a huge part of my focus was now on how do I bring efficiencies into the department? How do I get a tighter handle on the accounts receivable of this department that we are billing accurately and effectively and efficiently to bring money back into the hospital? The business aspects of what I learned in this space outside of just learning how to manage people, that propelled me, you know, again, here at 24, learning about accounts receivable and managing a daily $2 million revenue target. And that was just how much money was being put through this hospital on a regular basis, to do that on a daily basis. And now to think about how I do my accounts receivable in my own business, which is not 2 million, but one can dream. But that learning that occurred in that process, it's I'm forever grateful. Now, the interesting part here is a few months after I started, the director quit and took on a different job. And so I still as assistant director, my now interim boss was the CFO, and I marched up to her office and said, I want to be the director. And she said, no, you got out of college like 6 months ago. You can't be the director of this entire department.
That and sounds so like a CFO.
Yeah. I mean, she was not wrong to have that response.
Sure.
And so we interviewed people, and they attempted to hire people, and they offered someone a job. And a week before he was going to start, he said, I can't. I've taken another job. I'm not going to start. So I marched back up to her office and I said, okay, I'm all you got. You might as well make me the director. And she did. And she micromanaged the heck out of me appropriately. I do not fault her for that one bit, because there was a huge trust element that she had to build in me. And she was very direct and clear and an incredibly brilliant, strong woman, and such a great role model to have. And at moments I was really scared of her, and at moments I really wanted to make her proud. And so there's another element of getting a job that I hadn't been qualified for, because I literally begged for it, and maybe out of necessity she took a chance on me.
Yeah, it's fun to see the personality traits, having discussed earlier, come out in the different aspects. So you became the director of that department.
I did. And I did that for, I think, 3 years after that, and then left and went over to Cerner and was there for 14 years. That's the rounding out of the healthcare career thing. But yeah, I took on the leadership role of that department and learned a full heck of a
weird side item. And I'm probably going to have to just ask my friends about this, but the concept of a nonprofit being bought, I mean, obviously that can happen. Of course that can happen. But now my mind is going into this tailspin of like, where does the money go? Does the board at the time just split the funds? Because the whole point of a nonprofit is they can't make profit, and now they have a cash injection.
Yes.
That's yes. considerable because it's a business purchase. And I'm like, what happens with that money in a way that still makes a nonprofit a nonprofit? Or since it's not a nonprofit anymore, are we allowed to just fudge the rules there a little bit?
Well, so what actually happened with the money? So it was Health Midwest, which was a huge not-for-profit healthcare system here in Kansas City. And then HCA is the one that bought them out. And Health Midwest had hospitals in Kansas and in Missouri. So that money itself went to stand up two separate nonprofits that still exist today. On the Kansas side, it became Reach Healthcare Foundation, which still exists. On the Missouri side, it became Health Forward Foundation. So the proceeds from that sale did continue to serve in the nonprofit space, and both continue to serve the Kansas and Missouri communities today. So it's a great question, but you are exactly right. That couldn't just immediately turn into profit for a hospital that had been a nonprofit. It had to continue. I don't know the legalities behind this, but just practically speaking, that's what occurred with the sale of Health Midwest.
Thank you.
Interesting.
Because, the more I get into, I love asking these questions because it's just like, you know, once you understand just the general structure of nonprofit in general versus another, I have so much feelings for any of my friends that are running nonprofits. I have a friend that was his first business entity was a nonprofit. And I'm like, man, I think you jumped into the deep end really on that one, didn't you? Interesting. So you went over to Cerner for 14 years. Did we talk about this? I interned there back in like, I don't know, it would have been a few years, 2020. It had to have been about 2007.
I started in 2007. And I think we've played the name game before. And I think for the most part, we didn't end up coming up with anyone.
My supervisor in this moment now, though. Eric Wright, does that name sound familiar to you at all?
It doesn't.
No. All right, never mind. Somebody's going to be listening consulting. And be like, whoa.
Yeah, woo. Yeah, I was in consulting, and you were not in consulting.
I was in engineering. Yeah, that drastically changes things, for sure. So, there is so much stuff we didn't talk about. Yeah, that was regards to Cerner. I'm trying to decide if I'll kind of dive into this because I find this absolutely fascinating. And we can or don't have to talk about it. But the thing that interests me about Cerner that nobody really talks about is the alcoholic culture that at least existed in the engineering department. Now, it's not Cerner anymore, so my hope would be that the culture has to some end changed. You would think over changes that it has. But I don't know if it's fair to say it's unique to Cerner at all, but looking back, I was underage at the time, so I was a little bit fortunate, really, in that I couldn't drink even if I wanted to, and people seemed to like their job enough not to want to put it to risk. But there was very much an atmosphere of like, and I've heard people say you didn't advance if you didn't drink heavily.
Interesting. Well, I have a few thoughts. Consulting. Here's some of the things that I think point towards that. So, and I can only speak from my experience in the consulting space. So engineering might have been a different world. The consulting space there, I mean, I started there at 27. So I was actually an old hire, because most of the people that started at Cerner in consulting, they were 22 or 23. They started directly out of college, and then they immediately hit the road. So I traveled full time when I first started there, which was, it was great. I wasn't married. My husband and I were dating mostly from, we met just a few years after I started, or a few months after I started at Cerner. But most of the people there are
They're 22. They are being flown all over for many people the world. They're getting a per diem to spend, either ideally put it in their savings account, or to spend on a night out with their other 22-year-old friends before having to wake up and go into the office at 8 a.m. the next morning. There's a necessity there because you don't necessarily hire a lot of people who maybe have young kids and say, hey, go out and travel full time. Hiring people who are young, who have the flexibility, who are willing to work the really long hours to, and then, you know, you pay them well and you have, they create these great experiences. All of that was a little bit of a recipe for many people. It was their fifth, sixth, or seventh year of basically professional college where they were still able to go out and hang out with all of their friends and then go to work with all their friends the next day. But I also think that that culture, yes, there was definitely probably a lot of drinking that occurred, but it made, when we had a hospital conversion and when we would do an overnight, I mean, there was a lot of overnight shifts because healthcare is 24/7. You're now staying up all night supporting this technology project with a whole bunch of your friends. And so drinking coffee at 3 o'clock in the morning and eating snacks constantly to keep the energy up, it was a fun experience to be part of. So that was really unique. And Cerner had the motto that I'm sure you've heard, which was work hard, play hard. And so if you're going to work hard, you're going to work some really long days. And then on Fridays, we're going to throw a happy hour for the entire company and do a beer Friday in the cafeteria. I think all of that contributed to that type of culture that served a purpose for some people. Again, I felt old compared to a lot of the people that were there. So it was never necessarily a culture that I felt like I was definitely connected to. I was not going out all night with, at least not every night anyway, with all of my coworkers. But the community that it sort of created, right, wrong, or otherwise, did serve a purpose.
Yeah. Well,
what do you think about that?
No, it's a good... Well, it's interesting because I think you make a great point in that it's not like, and this wasn't what I was applying, but it helps check me in that, you know, it's not like we have some overlords here that are like, you know, we're just going to create a culture where everyone drinks, because that doesn't make sense. Who goes out and does that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. You know, the young nature of it. I mean, I was drinking plenty at 21, 22, 23. And the work hard, play hard aspect of it, which is an interesting, you know, it's an interesting motto. Looking back, I don't know if I personally agree with it for the same reason the whole DISC tests. I don't know if you have to have both. Uh-huh. So like I've been called a workaholic. But I honestly don't view it as work in the same way that I did. I'll tell people I'm working for the sake of them understanding what's happening right now. But I don't know if internally I see it as the same type of work as when I worked your traditional 9-to-5 position. And so... You know, in the same, anyway, I don't know where I'm getting at exactly with that. It's just fascinating to me because, and I've since received confirmation, even in some cases, I've talked to people that have gone through rehab that had a Cerner history. And so it's just an interesting thing that now that I'm older, and I only interned for like 6 months, I didn't, to be fair, I didn't cut the mustard. I wasn't the guy that they wanted at the time. And also 08 happened. So, you know, it was just kind of a perfect storm. But looking back now, it's just this weird concept for me because it's like, wow, what an interesting culture, I guess. So every now and again, I like to talk about it because it's weird to me now for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah.
To your point, maybe it's the same sort of like, I'm older now, so if I was in that environment currently, I wouldn't connect with it in the same way. So I almost look back at my younger self like, what are you doing?
Yeah. You know, well, so here's what I will say about my experience at Cerner. And I'm sure a lot of people that listen to this are from, are from Kansas City. So it's a familiar, talking about Cerner is probably very familiar for many people. It was a company where risk-taking was fully embraced if you took smart risks. So people who took reckless risks probably would have struggled, and they were probably ushered out of the company. But if you could take risks that were calculated, that were based on probably some smart research, talking to the right people, connecting with the right people, making some challenging inquiries in the right way, you had a lot of opportunity to try different things on. And I fully embraced that culture. I grew my career very, very quickly at Cerner. And I did that through taking calculated smart risks and trying things in a safe way that maybe hadn't been tried before. And if they didn't work, they didn't work. But when they did work, it became an opportunity to kind of say, hey, look, I tried something different. Look at me, everyone. And that, in an interesting way, paid off. And I mean, this all comes back. We're seeing these themes and me having this willingness to try new things that I didn't entirely know how to do, but to have enough understanding of a process and studying people and asking the questions to say, I think I can push the limits here a little bit. And it worked. But Cerner was a beautiful space for me to be able to do that and grow a career in that way.
No, and you're so right. And I was going to say that was the culture aspect I didn't see, but that wouldn't be true. I hadn't even graduated college. And they were starting this new internship program. Not that I think internships were that new to them, but this particular program, which was basically going to be a paid part-time intern transition out of college into a full-time position. That concept, I think, was new to them. And out of some 200 applicants, I was one of 12, I believe it was, is what we came down to. And you're in that same vein, you're right that, and I really didn't have, I mean, I told them in the interview for the most part, I said, man, because they said acronyms and things that I didn't know anything about. And I pretty much told them, I said, look, I remember saying, this is a springboard that I won't take for granted. And, you know, I may not know everything, but I'll figure it out pretty darn quickly. Something mm-hmm. along the lines of your, mm-hmm. and I met my hiring manager sometime afterwards, just in the elevator. And he was like, yeah, you put up a good fight. Me and the other one, we both liked you. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But you're right. So, and it's fascinating too, because for the size of the company, most of the time that culture, if it ever existed, dies out a long time ago. And so they kind of maintained the value of a small business in the size, which I don't know how they would have done that, really. It's a marvel, truly, when you think about it. Because that ability to pivot, that ability to allow risk, that ability to excel quickly is the type of thing you might see in a small business. But typically in like a corporate ladder structure, right? You're looking at a scenario where like your manager has been there for 40 years and you're hoping here in a minute they retire so you can inherit their position and then maybe keep going, right?
Mm-hmm. But it also changed a lot. I mean, I saw all iterations of Cerner and different leaders that were there. Neil Patterson, the founder, who was, you know, still the CEO for a large portion of my career there. And then after he passed away, it changed dramatically from a company that did understand that in order to shake things up in the healthcare space, you have to take risk and encourage innovation. And I did see it shift into a company that did function a lot more like a typical large company. And I'm sure there's a million things that are under the, you know, behind the scenes that I'm not privy to. But this is such a huge part of what sparked what I speak about now is encouraging an entire workforce, whether it's a small business and you've got 5 people or 10 people or you've got 10,000 people. If you can create this culture that does allow every single person to feel like they're a part of doing something differently and bringing creativity into their work, it absolutely changes the experience for the employees and it pushes a company in a way that maybe you as the solo leader didn't even see as a possibility. And I will always say I feel so grateful to have spent so much time in a place that allowed me to grow and cultivate and kind of shape that experience for myself.
That's cool. So tell me about the transition out of Cerner.
Yeah.
14 years, that's quite a bit of time. What sparked the transition?
It was a long time coming, probably. So I was an executive.
And were you cultivating the new dream while you were working there?
Yes, I would say that I was. Although I maybe didn't entirely realize it at the time. So my oldest daughter was born in 2014. So I had been there for 7 years at that point. And I had moved from an individual contributor to an executive in a few years. It was a pretty rapid transition. And then my oldest daughter was born and I made the decision to be a stay-at-home mom, which was that is a whole other conversation. And that kind of emotional shift of bringing a child in. And anyway, that's a whole other conversation probably, but I said I wanted to go from being this leader of, you know, a team that was working really all across the world and a couple hundred people scattered throughout, and to say, okay, I'm gonna quit and be a stay-at-home mom. And my boss
and
at
I remember
the time,
talking about this a little bit because Cerner did have a beautiful maternal paternal program. Actually, I remember even, and I was single. Unless I'm wrong, maybe I'm wrong.
No,
but I
no,
remember it being pretty impressive.
They had 4 weeks unpaid, 6 weeks if you had a normal delivery, 8 weeks for a C-section. I had a C-section, so I did get 12 weeks of FMLA, so my job was protected for 12 weeks. Eight was paid, 4 weeks was unpaid. So there was nothing remarkable about it. I think my daughter was about 6 months old. She was at the Cerner daycare. That was fantastic to have her right across the campus from me. Then I went into my boss's office when she was right at 6 months old, and I said, I think I need to quit my job. And
was the daycare something you had to pay for, by the way? Because that may be interesting. All right. Now I understand why you reacted the way that you did.
Such a wait list.
Never mind.
And I felt so grateful to get in there. And it was a wonderful, it was great.
Sure.
But I told my boss, I'm ready to quit. And I just feel like I'm not making the right decision in my life right now to keep showing up here and giving my all here. And my boss said, you know, would you consider staying part-time? And I thought, well, I mean, I can always quit again if it doesn't work. And so I said yes. And he was, I still credit him for being, he's now the CIO over at WellSky, Neil Schwartz. Shout out, Neil. He was such a integral part of me navigating that state of my life. And I'm obviously, I keep talking about gratitude here, but that was something that I was really grateful for, having that flexibility. So I went part-time, became an individual contributor. He gave me the title of special operations, and I took on little projects that really needed to be addressed for consulting, but that people really just didn't have that bandwidth to focus on. So I got to do a whole bunch of fun stuff. And I did that for a number of years. My second daughter was born, and then I ended up coming back full time and in a role that was titled faculty. Then I stood up in front of a room of individuals who were employed by the VA, and I taught them how to use data and analytics to improve veteran outcomes. And there was a whole team of us that did that. And in that process, my boss at the time, so shout out to Mike Allison, he really helped grow my skills as a public speaker. And he was the one that first introduced me to what this world outside of the corporate world could look like, and that there could be a career in being a keynote speaker. And you said, did I do any of this while still working? He introduced me to my first non-Cerner client while I was still at Cerner. And so I went and did a workshop on becoming a trusted advisor for a client. And I thought, well, heck, that was kind of fun. And I made some money and I enjoyed it. And they invited me to come back and do something else. And I thought, yeah, this really could be a career opportunity. And so there was some confidence that I experienced along the way that got me to that point. Then I think ultimately I was ready for the next opportunity and the next way to challenge myself a little bit. And that's what my business became.
That's a great starter workshop too, becoming a trusted, because everybody wants that, right?
Yeah.
But not everybody, I don't think, wants to necessarily go through the work to make that happen. But then once you have that status, which is an interesting thing, because it's not like you can say, point to a specific thing necessarily, unless, and you correct me, maybe you know more. But that notion that the client that pays you trusts you to the point of like asking you for recommendations on other things or inviting you to a party or something, like that next layer of like just deep connection where it's an implicit trust. Is
yes. So I started that. Somebody would say, can you come and do a keynote on insert XYZ topic? And I'd say, yeah, definitely I can. So I you know, they always say when you're building a speaking business, you get your reps in. So I said yes, and I customized things, and it was a lot of work, but I got myself on stage in front of an audience every opportunity I could. And then behind the scenes, I was working on crafting my unique message, which is what I deliver today. And it all comes back to creativity in the workplace. But it's baby steps the whole time, I guess.
So what were your first couple speaking engagements like? Because I remember, not that I've had a ton, you've probably had way more reps than me, but I distinctly remember that first one to the point to where it was like, it's I don't know. Anybody that thinks that I just started this way, it's like, oh, no, that first one was the worst. I hated it, and I was the one giving it.
Yeah. Oh, I loved it. I do. I remember my first one. It was at Spotlight Analyst Relations. So Spotlight here in Kansas City. It was their annual conference, January of 2022. And I was their keynote speaker for their conference. But leading up to that, so that last role that I'd had at Cerner when I was faculty, there was a group of us and we coached each other constantly. We critiqued every aspect of how we stood and delivered. So I had been through years of speaking coaching by this little team of the best speakers that existed at Cerner. I'd been through so much coaching already to get to that point. So when I took the stage for the first time as a keynote speaker for another company, it was like the best opportunity to bring this years of what I'd studied for so long to light. And to let it be my own. And yeah, I ate it up. It was the best. It was a high that it's why I keep doing so much of it. And I know many people who are speakers will say, I get up on stage to inspire everyone that's in the room. And there is absolute truth to that. And also you have to get energy from that work. You have to be excited about that work or you're not going to keep going. So for me, yes, I love delivering the message. Yes, I love watching the audience nod or smile or connect with something that I said and then hearing about how they applied it afterwards. But I also will say it gives me something in a way that no other work ever really has.
I love that for you. I love that. It explains, too, the potential difference. My first time giving a real kind of presentation for myself was basically also the first time giving a presentation at all. So I had memorized the script and I sounded like a robot. It was, I didn't have any tonality or arm movement, let alone dressing up as a Barbie or something. And
you didn't show up in costume.
No, I think I read from three different pages. And that's for me, I had to throw it away because I was like, okay, we're going to try the next one with like an outline at best. And that's when I kind of built my way up. Mm-hmm. But so, okay. So when was that again? You said January 22. Did I hear that right?
Yeah.
That's exciting. That's quite exciting.
Yeah. So it's been 3 full years that I've been doing this work. And every year has been different. And I've learned a lot in the process. And I want to keep going. You know, I don't see an end anywhere in sight, which is fun to be able to be a part of something that I do want to keep growing in and investing my time in and building.
What does it look like to, this is going to sound really weird, but I am curious and I have to be careful and conscious of time here, but what does it look like to curate that calendar? If that makes any sense, because it's like, you know, you perfect world, you create some sort of pipeline, right? And then you've got to get it all on the calendar and then you've got to bring it all and you got to prep for each one after it. That's hopefully, right? That's the kind of scenario. How has that been for you?
So this year is the first year that I feel like I have a good answer to that.
Okay.
So year one, you know, it was a lot of just figuring things out. Year two continued of just saying yes, 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 yes. This year is the year that I am being very intentional with my time. I am doing less coffee meetings and networking meetings and focusing more on my craft. The tangible part of this is I now, and I'm looking at it right now, I have a massive, it is probably 6 foot by 6 foot wall calendar. Because I've had to visually change how I see the calendar. Because before, you know, I had my Google calendar and I still use that and it's all color coded and all the little details of what I'm doing go there. And I always block Mondays and Fridays for my days to work on the business, which is not necessarily time to practice, but it's things like going through expenses or making sure that I've got the invoices out that I need to. It's the businessy stuff. But what I've done this year is create a visual representation of what I have coming up. So what are the weeks that I have a keynote or that I have a workshop? What are the times that I know I need in advance of each of those to prepare? And I have, you know, a good example is September. I have 2 speaking events in September, towards the end of September. But I have blocked the entire month of September because these 2 speaking events are big enough events that I do not want anything else in the mix to distract from it. There's other speaking events that I already know the message that I'm delivering, so I will do some customization and I will prepare. And I do memorize what I'm going to say, so I know the words that are coming next. But in that moment, should I choose to adjust them a little bit because they're memorized, I have the ability to adjust. So I do spend time before each one, but this year I've said no to a lot of things that are detracting from my ability to 100% focus on doing what I want to be doing, which is keynote speaking and growing that business as best as I can.
That's beautiful. That's cool. That's cool. So I'm about to start to wrap up here, but just before, is there anything we missed along the way other than like the bringing a child into this world and juggling that? And that's its own thing that isn't talked about anywhere near enough. But you are right. I actually had to stop myself, because if we allowed each other to talk about that, that would definitely be its own episode.
It would. Well, here's what I will say. One of the core principles to what I talk about now with creativity is the idea that we have to support each other on the path towards achieving our dreams. So we started talking about dreams back in the beginning. I do believe that we don't achieve our dreams on our own. We have to rely on the people around us to help us. And so, Sam, I have to acknowledge how you and I first met, which was you helping me, because I had been, you know, this keynote that I was giving when you and I first met was a keynote that this was a year for me to really go big and bold with my message. And I'm comfortable on stage to where I want to take some risks and show up dressed as Weird Barbie and have props on stage and do a lot of things that push myself outside of my comfort zone. And in the midst of this talk of pushing myself out of my comfort zone, every technical challenge that could have gone wrong happened. And that was how you and I first met, because you became my lifeline. You were just an audience member. You just showed up to be in the audience and participate in this networking event. And you became part of my team unknowingly and created such a sense of comfort to know that I could turn to you to say, hey, I'm having this technical challenge. Just go work on it while I talk to the audience. And you did it, and you owned that. And you became part of my dream team. And I know that day would not have been what it was without you having been there. So I'm going to use the word grateful again, but dang, I was grateful for you that night, and I remain grateful for you today.
Well, thank you. But for the sake of this recording, and as an homage to your message, you were talking about how certain people unwittingly become participants in your dream. And what was kind of interesting was my helping you. You were very, to your point about grateful, you were very grateful as I was helping, and you didn't necessarily mind shouting me out, which I was incredibly appreciative. That plays well into my personality. But what it also does is it fills me up. So then I had the courage afterwards to more confidently talk to people about what it is I do. Because sometimes I think in the moment, especially in like an after hours thing, sometimes you have this moment of it's like, is what I do really valuable? Not to say I was thinking that day, just to say that when you have an immediate confirmation that what you do is valuable and helpful and useful, it's a lot easier to then immediately turn around and be like, hey, what I have is valuable, useful, and helpful. Do you want it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you.
Well, and thank you so much.
So, okay, we have two questions we like to leave this thing on.
Okay.
So the first question is, we have a motto over here that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to that has allowed you to see further?
I will say my mom. She also started her own business. She grew it successfully. She showed me how it could be done. She was a lifeline in the very beginning when I said, how do I set up an LLC? She walked me through that. And what should my invoice look like? She walked me through that. But then on top of that, watching someone, you know, as a child, watching her do that. And I'll mention my dad, because he also was a small business owner. But watching someone come before you do that and be passionate about the work that they are doing, it just shows you what is possible.
That's cool. The last question is, if you had a guiding principle or rule of thumb that you are saying, pithy saying, that you found true again and again and again, what would that be?
Help me think through this. That would be it. So calling up somebody, throwing a wild idea out there and saying to somebody, will you help me think through this? And the reason why I think that's so powerful is it goes back to the team element. It brings somebody else in, but you're simply asking for help. You're not transferring ownership. You're not making it a mandate that they help you come up with the perfect answer. You're just saying, help me think through this. And it opens up new doors. And by allowing someone to help you, the psychology of that is they become invested in you. And now they want to see your success. And it becomes this beautiful kind of reciprocal opportunity.
That's a good one. Help me think through this. Because I'm sure you know too, Mary, more people further along the dream, they think differently than we do. And so it that's a powerful one.
And just because they did it a certain way doesn't mean you have to do it a certain way.
No.
But what they've learned can help you think about how you might want to do that.
Thank you so much for being on, Mary, and coming. It's been such a pleasure to have you as a guest.
Absolutely. Thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed this.
My pleasure. Goodbye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.